New York. This hour of programming is paid for by the Talkline Communications Network.
Welcome to Headlines, Halakhic Debate of Current Events, a weekly interactive program on some of the most controversial breaking issues of today. Here now is your host, David Lichtenstein, founder and CEO of the Lightstone Group, and author of Headlines.
Good evening. Tonight we'll be speaking about a very contemporary topic, which is using torture as an interrogation technique. And we will have as our guest Rabbi Menachem Ginak. Rabbi Ginak is the Rav of the OU, which is the Rav HaMachshir, the largest Rav HaMachshir in America. He's also one of the foremost Talmidim of the Rav Zichron Livracha, Rabbi Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik, under whom he studied for 10 years. And it's an honor to have him with us. Everybody who's been watching the news is aware of the controversy that this has generated, with the CIA report coming out recently about the torture that it used both in Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere. And many people have wondered, what is the halachic view of torture? Is it permitted? Is it not permitted? Now, I want to preface this conversation by saying clearly, this is for discussion purposes only. And whereas usually we say, ask your local Orthodox rabbi, in this case, I don't suggest you even ask your local Orthodox rabbi, and do not try it at home, regardless of what you hear on this show. But we would like to open up, discuss it from a more, you know, this has been discussed in some level or another in the Talmud for over 2,000 years. And let's take a look at it, what our very rich culture says about it. For the purposes of segregating it into some manageable chunks, I suggest that we divide it into two ways. The first way would be, let's discuss intra-Jewish terrorism. For example, let's say we had an ultra-right-wing Jewish terrorist or an ultra-left-wing Jewish terrorist. And then afterwards, we'll talk about what is more the norm in Israel, where we would have, you know, Arab terrorists. So Rabbi Ginak, are you on the line?
Yes.
So Rabbi Ginak, what would your opinion be if they caught an ultra-right-wing terrorist? Well, let's start in the most extreme case, where he had planted a ticking time bomb in a square in Tel Aviv for the purposes of making some type of a political expression. Would you say halachically torture would be permitted to elicit from him where the bomb is so as to save lives of onlookers?
Well, you know, before we address that specific case, well, just in general context, as Reb David mentioned, you know, we're not paskening shylessly. This is, as he said, for discussion purposes only. But, you know, the thing that makes this so relevant now is because of the Feinstein report about the CIA and their Senate conclusion in opposition to using torture as a means of gaining information from terrorists or from others. So there are several issues that we have to deal with, which we're not going to deal with beyond our purview, but the Senate report suggests or claims, and this is a matter of complete dispute by members of the CIA, certainly Vice President Cheney disputed it, but one issue is how credible is information that we get under torture, because people under torture can say all kinds of things. And then the other issue is, which doesn't probably apply in this context, but is in general, is it counterproductive for our general standing in the world, I'm talking about the United States now, and is it helpful in terms of the battle that we're engaged in against terrorism? So we're not dealing with that in our conversation, but of course that is an important issue in terms of, you know, should we use, should torture be a part of the tools that are in our toolkit in terms of fighting terrorism or not? Is it effective or not? So putting that to the side, having said that, in terms of a terrorist, as Dover just described, where he set a bomb, we don't know where he set it, it would seem at least it would seem to me, that it would, assuming that the only way we can get this information, it would be credible information, is through torture, that would be permitted. Because, first of all, we know there's halacha. This terrorist himself, I mean, from two contexts, first of all, he's also obligated, lo samar al dam riyacha, to protect other Jewish lives. And we, in general, by el mitzvahs, we force people to do mitzvahs. Makin asher tishpeche nafsho, and Bezdin can force a person, presuming it's Bezdin, to that's an issue where it has to be necessarily Bezdin, but let's assume that it's Bezdin, that has to force him, can force a person, just we can force a person to take lulav, to put on tefillin, we should be able to force him to get this information. I should take Jinafso. Whether Teitzi Nafso means actually till he dies, or Ad for Adlo Bechlau, is a question in Poskim. Piskarov in his Kedusha Minoza says it's not Ad for Ad Bechlau. Chazanish was Masufk about it. Others think that it is Bechlau. So, but that would be permitted. The other issue in this very specific case, if he's the one who set the bomb, so he's a Roidif. And you can kill a Roidif to sell other people. So if you can kill the Roidif, you can use any means to get this information, presumably from him, to save the lives of the people who would be injured or killed because of this bomb.
So if he were not a, if he hadn't planted it himself, but he was merely aware of it, so he would not be a Roidif in that case, but it would only be also Samar al Dam Riecha. It would only be else the obligation to save other lives. Is that correct?
I think so. I mean, offhand, if he has this information, but he didn't do it, he's not the Roidif.
So let me extend that. Let's say it was not it was not intra-Jewish, but it was an Arab terrorist who planted a bomb, and another Arab was aware of it, but was not part of that cell. Now this fellow does not have a mitzvah of losamed al dam riecha, does not have a mitzvah of hatzalah. What would be the means of getting information from this person who was aware of the ticking time bomb? It could be more problematic in that case.
It may be more problematic. It may still be permitted on several levels. First of all, it may be simply pikuach nefesh. Just like in Michal Shabbos for Pikuach Nefesh, it's an Issa Skila, you can be over on the Issa Chavala and so on that would be necessary to save other people. So Pikuach Nefesh of the other potential victims. And beyond that, we're right now engaged in a war against terrorists. Most of them, you know, nowadays a lot of them are within the Arab or Muslim world, extremists, fundamentalists. Like ISIS and Bashar's Milchama in a time of war, extraordinary means are permitted. Whenever we go to war, we know that they're going to be korbanos, they're going to be soldiers killed on both sides. We know there'll be innocent victims in the war as well. And this is a battle that we're engaged in with the Arab world. So when Dine Milchama, it would seem that it would be permitted.
Now, in the case where it was a Jew who was aware of it, but who hadn't planted the bomb, could an argument be made that since he's not revealing it, he actually becomes a Rodef too, since he is not, because he can save other people, even though he was not complicit in planting it?
Maybe. I mean, in terms of Rodef, there are different kinds of Rodefs. There's a Rodef who's actually pursuing another person, attempting to kill him. And then there could be a Rodef even inadvertently and even if he's not doing anything. If the Gemara gives the case of Rodef, that the Rambam says it's based on the law of Rodef, that if a woman is pregnant and she's about to give birth and the birth could kill her, that you're allowed to save the mother by killing the fetus to save her, and the Rambam says that's based on the halacha of Rodef. The Meir says once the head has come out, so ein doch nefesh b'nei nefesh. Interesting, the Meir is of the opinion that's other people, but the mother herself can still save herself even in that case. This is a, this maybe coincides or is in support of the position of the Mishnah Melech. Mishnah Melech quotes the position that this halacha by Lodeth that you have to use minimum force, Yochel Atzil Be'ech Me'avav, is only somebody else. But the Nirdaf, the victim or the potential victim, can save himself by killing the Lodeth no matter what, even if he could have done it in a different fashion, and if he could have shoot him in the head, he could have shot him in the leg. But for the Nirdaf himself, it's permitted. But so we see in terms of the Uber, you don't have to actually be. But then, of course, the Uber is doing a particular action, you know, not consciously, it's being born. So if that's true, even B'Shevi Al-Taisa, maybe that would apply in this case as well. But, of course, it's a little bit of a stretch because at least the Uber there, they're not exactly the same. Uber is it's the Uber that's going to kill the mother without intention. So it is...
Uber is the missile, in effect.
It's the missile. I mean, in terms of this, it's worth reading this wonderful book by David Lichtenstein called Headlines. In a different context, he has an article about it, for example, what if there's a plane that's about the... There was a case in 9/11, a plane that was going to bang into a building and kill thousands of people. Would you have been allowed to shoot down that plane? By shooting it down, you're killing all the innocent people on the plane. But maybe it's permitted to save all the other lives. We know that, in fact, the United States, Vice President Cheney, who then, President Bush was not at the White House, he was out, and Cheney was in command to a certain degree. He had given instructions, if they could, to shoot down these planes. So this, an important reference for you to look at is Rabbi Lichtenstein's wonderful book, Headlines.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Ginnack. Rabbi Ginnack, what would be the argument against using torture if, indeed, in times of war, torture would be permitted? Because a lot of, you know, the laws that of during a time of civilian peace are lifted. And additionally, for the purposes of saving lives, other laws are lifted. What would be the arguments against using torture? Like, we don't want to come out clearly on Dick Cheney's side.
Well, it would come back, you know, the arguments, it comes back to the CIA report. The argument would be that maybe using torture, first of all, the question is how credible the information is and how much, you know, is the loss in terms of, let's say it was the United States in the context that we're talking about in terms of the support, did the use of torture, we know, other countries know that we're using it, other combatants know, does that radicalize our enemy? And therefore, instead of having 100 terrorists that we have to deal with, we have 1,000, and then we have to deal with how much information do we get? Is it worth it? The bad effect in terms of radicalizing the enemy as opposed to the value of this information. And the CIA report claims that when we caught bin Laden, it was not based on the information that we got from torture. It was not, waterboarding and so on. That wasn't effective and didn't help us leading us towards bin Laden. So that's a very practical question.
If you look at the news today, you see that the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini, tweeted, "Look how humanity is being treated by dominant powers with their flashy propaganda in the name of human rights, democracy, and freedom." So your point is that when we torture, it causes, on the contrary, it comes back to us with plus interest.
Right. So then, but then the question is, maybe on a military basis, the information is so valuable that it's a trade-off. The question is, which is, and that's very much what's in dispute between Senator Feinstein and her members of her committee, the Democratic members at least, and those who dispute it. I mean, even if one would agree with it, I mean, one could also argue that it's not so smart to have let this report out. You know, there's a cost to this transparency that, again, all this bad information is out, and it gives this Ayatollah you just quoted, Khomeini, the opportunity to cite a Senate report to, you know, confirm or affirm what he's saying.
So, Rabbi Ginnack, let me give you six or seven possible reasons to consider why torture should possibly halachically be problematic. Okay. One possibility is the possibility of chilul Hashem, a profaning God's name. Many nations take the position that the Geneva Convention disallows torture in any situation. So, chilul Hashem is people die for chilul Hashem. So, with the concern of chilul Hashem, even though it's halachically permitted, would that be a reason to disallow torture? Now, we know that there are many cases that halachically you are allowed to do something, but they're disallowed for the purposes of chilul Hashem. We could cite many different cases like that. So the fact that it's halachically a cow is not a reason to say that it is not a chilul Hashem. So would that be a consideration?
Well, again, I think it would be a consideration in the broad kind. I mean, let's just talk about Israeli policy in the war in Gaza. You know, we know that the Israelis, contrary to, you know, shamefully what the UN and these human rights commissions in the UN, which are, of course, populated by the biggest violators of human rights, Syria and others, who are members of this commission. But Israel used in extraordinary efforts to avoid civilian casualties in Gaza. But the reason it did that was not only because of one was simply a human consideration, but it was also because of a political consideration. After all, the war is just is a means of diplomacy by different means. So Israel is always calculating in also the plus and minus in terms of whatever it does. So in terms of Chilul Hashem, it would be, you know, Chilul Yisrael, in the sense that, you know, would that, if Israel were to use torture as an example, of course Chilul Hashem in the American context is a little bit more difficult, but, you know, that would be a factor, I would think, on a basis, you know, does it promote Israel's agenda and its standing in the world? But if Api Halach it's really permitted, the Chil Hashem means that something that was inappropriate was done, and that's the Chil Hashem. I don't know the standard of Chil Hashem should be the misconceptions of different governments or enemies, but I'm sure it would factor in what would be the perception in the world and whether that helps or hurts Israel. For example, right now, we can be certain that in the Israeli foreign ministry and other places, they are trying to figure out, whether correctly or incorrectly, where is this, in this enormous chess game that's going on. We see, shamefully, that Europe has taken Hamas, at least they say for technical reason, but they've taken Hamas, this EU court, off the terrorist list. Many European countries have said in their parliaments that they're about to recognize Palestine. The EU voted about it last week. So how we approach these things, because those are very important issues in terms of where Israel stands politically in the world, economically, and those have enormous security ramifications for Israel. So for sure those are things that have to be taken into account.
You are listening to Headlines, Halakhic Debates of Current Events with David Lichtenstein, founder and CEO of the Lightstone Group and author of Headlines. Please call 212-769-1925 with your questions and comments. That's 212-769-1925. You can also email us at info@talklinecommunications.com. That's info@talklinecommunications.com. If you are enjoying tonight's radio show, please make sure to read David Lichtenstein's important and innovative new book of the same title as this broadcast, Headlines, Halakhic Debate of Current Events, published by OU Press. Embark on a fascinating journey through halakha on some of the most important and controversial breaking issues of the day. Available at your local Jewish booksellers and at Amazon.com.
TCN, Talk Line Communications Network Radio, America's number one Jewish program.
And tonight, the special guest is Rabbi Menachem Ganach of the OU, and in just a few moments, we'll be taking your phone calls at 212-769-1925. That's 212-769-1925. if you want to weigh in, if you think torture is okay or not okay, you have questions about the discussion tonight. Again, the number to call in is 212-769-1925. 212-769-1925. Email is a wonderful way to get through as well. And that's info@talklinecommunications.com. And now, back to the program.
So, Rabbi Ginnack, let me ask you another question. Let me present a few more arguments to why torture could possibly be illegal. The Gemara says that when you hang somebody, in extreme case where somebody committed an act heinous enough to require the death penalty, immediately after he was killed, his body had to be removed from the his body had to be cut down. He was not allowed to be left hanging. And the language of the pasuk is ki kill us alekim tali. The image of God is hanging on the tree. And we all know that man is made b'tzelem alekim in the image of God. And Rashi says the exegesis on the verse says. It's like somebody whose relative is hanging on the tree. Every time they see it, cringes. So we see a concept here that to desecrate any human being, it's a type of a desecration of the Ribbono Shel Olam, of God. Isn't torturing a human being, putting them through the most inhumane, disgusting, revolting? You read the CIA reports about the feces put in food, people kept awake for 150 hours with constant beatings, etc. Isn't that the worst invocation of ki kill us alekim tali, desecrating the image of God? Wouldn't that be a reason, and that would say, find another way to get that information from this individual?
Well, I think we all would agree that if we could find another way of getting that information, absolutely we should. And there is an issue of Tzelem Elokim, and torture shouldn't be used unless it's the only option. And as we spoke about with all the other caveats, that it's really effective, which is very questionable. So, in the example that you gave where a person is chayiv misa, they gave him skila and then they do tliya, so he's taken off right away. And there's always, the whole halach of kavod ames is a function of because of the tzelem elokim. That's why from that same halach we learn that kfura has to take place in general, not only chayuvim misas bezdin, in general, that we bury a person lo solin is also derived from there. So I agree absolutely. But it doesn't obviate if there would be a need to save people's lives, so that Tzelem Elokim is also significant. But of course, it's something that should only be used in extreme cases, and only if it's really effective. We know that the Gemara says that even when we give a person misa, some is chayv misa and is given a capital offense. Mochazal learned parolo misa yafa, that they should do it in the most, least painful and most, so to speak, aesthetic fashion. So that's even a person who's chayv misa. Certainly, we would say that a person who's alive and being tortured, that principle would apply.
Now, how would you suggest, Rabbi Ginnack, there's another issue about torture, and that is what it does to the perpetrators. The CIA report, as released by Senator Feinstein, talks about how the torturers become psychopaths and, in effect, become inhuman. And a society that allows torture becomes tainted by that very same brush. And we, for example, in Kant of Shiluach HaKan, we have the Ramban who says that what is the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKan? He says, because the Torah wants people to be merciful, and it doesn't want cruelty to spread among the humans, something that once people become used to cruelty, it starts to perpetrate, it starts to society. So he says we have to do our utmost not to allow cruelty, the perpetration of cruelty, into our midst. Do you fear that allowing torture damages our society, and therefore, because of the rule of Shiluach HaKan, is a reason to possibly disallow it?
Well, I think these are all important arguments which would, you know, we would consider in terms of how effective torture is. And one of them is that, you know, it would be the common use of the program of torture that could, you know, contaminate our own values and us and society. So, again, we're talking about something. You know, to be fair, we don't know in terms of the balance of the Feinstein report. You know, the CIA claims this was used, you know, sparingly and only with, you know, on those people. For the number of people we're talking about were tortured, was relatively small. But again, you know, we know that torture, it's worse than death. I mean, you know, David is going to cite, I'm sure, later on, Shitim Kubetsis relative to that. So I think all of these are things that whoever's creating a program in terms of a security program would, in all cases, avoid torture. And these would be arguments on the ledger, what you just said as well. Because, you know, Yaakov Avinu, when he goes to battle with Esav, says that he prays Shiloh, both of them, maybe he'll be killed, or maybe he'll have to kill. So he's concerned also about killing others. Golda Meir was famous for having said, I think she stole it to Sadat as well, that she blames him not only for the, you know, for the sons, her sons, namely the sons of Israel, the Israeli soldiers, Tzal, who were killed in battles, but also that they had to, that they had to become, you know, people who did kill as soldiers because of the impact that it has on them. But of course, that doesn't mean because of that, which we of course mourn, that we shouldn't have an army and protect the state of Israel.
Okay.
You are listening to Headlines, Halakhic Debates of Current Events with David Lichtenstein, founder and CEO of the Lightstone Group and author of Headlines. Please call 212-769-1925 with your questions and comments. That's 212-769-1925. You can also email us at info@talklinecommunications.com. That's info@talklinecommunications.com.
And let's go to Chaim in Flatbush. Your question for David Lichtenstein and Rabbi Ben Nachum Ganak. Go ahead, Chaim in Flatbush.
There's an halacha that when someone comes towards you to kill you, you have a right to kill him. So what kind of thing is this that you are not allowed to torture?
We didn't say that you're not allowed to talk.
You have to lower your radio, Chaim.
Yeah, Chaim, I don't think we came to that conclusion. I think you're right. Abola ha'ogacho hashkein v'ho'go. And if it's a terrorist, you know, the question is, in terms of public policy, is torture a good policy? But I think we were saying, you know, these are things that anybody who's in a commander in a position, you know, the prime minister, these are things that they, you know, if they're doing it up here, halacha, they're factoring all of these things in terms of what's the right position for them to take in each case. So there are things pro and con, but fundamentally, if we see that this is going to save lives, just like you can kill a voidif to save lives, and we can force a person to do a mitzvah, we can force him as well, to, you know, to get that information out of him.
I would also add, Chaim, let's say the person if somebody's coming at you with a knife, you're clearly allowed to defend yourself and kill him, right? But let's say they go into a neighborhood and they grab an entire cell of terrorists, 50 terrorists, who are all part of that cell. Now, many of those terrorists are accomplices. They're not people who are actually going to be carrying bombs or guns, so they wouldn't rise to the level of Habala Hargech if somebody is coming to kill you. They're part of a general terrorist organization, and they have information that would be helpful. Would you be allowed to torture these people? They're not Bala Hargech. They never would carry a gun. They wouldn't carry a knife. Maybe one's a secretary of the organization. Maybe one's, give funds to the organization. Maybe one provides an empty apartment for the organization. It wouldn't rise to the level of Abba Lahargei Hashkim Lahargo. In such a case, would you be allowed to torture? Additionally, what you have to consider is the fact that you're allowed to kill him, does that mean that you're allowed to torture him? In many ways, torture is more degrading than killing. Rabbi Ganak mentioned before, Shita Mekubetzes, that says that Hananya, Mishael, Vazariah were thrown into the oven, and the Shita Mekubetzes says that if they had been tortured, the Gemara says, if they had been tortured, they would not have been able to survive. If the death, they would have been able to survive, but torture not. So the Shita Mekubetzes makes the pretty obvious comment, I think it's obvious, that torture is considered worse than death. So the fact that Haba Lahargei Hashkim Lahargei, somebody's coming at you with a knife, you can kill him, that doesn't necessarily mean you can, pull his fingernails off before you kill him, or whatever other, chop his testicles off before you kill him. So there's a certain inhumane degradation and pain about torture that goes beyond killing, and that's really, what the CIA report is about, and that's really what we're trying to figure out here, the halachic status of that. Does that answer your question? Do we still have Chaim?
Chaim moved on, and we'll take some more phone calls at 212-769-1925, looking at the complex issue of torture and halakhically what is permissible and what is not permissible. You can email us also, info@talklinecommunications.com. And courtesy of Deli 52 in Borough Park tonight, we're going to give away a $50 gift certificate to a good question tonight, courtesy of the Hanukkah. That's Deli 52 in Brooklyn, 212-769-1925. A good question tonight. We'll get the $50 gift certificate from Deli 52. Back to the program.
Rabbi Ganak, there's another question that possible reason to consider. In the case of Malkus, it's a sort of similar to Kikilas Aleikim Tali. We know that you're not allowed to hit more than 39 times, and the Rishonim say that the reason is because Nikla Le Necha, that the Zipernu says, is that somebody who gets Malkus, more than 39 Malkus, often soils their clothing, they wet their pants, etc. And again, the degradation of human, he says, no matter what sin a person does, it shouldn't allow for the degradation. Do we have any evidence anywhere in the Torah that degradation that goes beyond 39 Malkus is allowed? There's like a link missing to the puzzle. Like we sort of the Shita Mekubetzes, we don't seem to have any place that shows that beyond Misa, that degradation, abuse, infliction of is allowed. And that is an argument to be made to say, at any level, no matter what the situation is, that should be disallowed. It's particular interest, that on the Yom Tov of Chanukah we're discussing this, because the Ramban writes in the war between the Malach of Esav and Yaakov, he says is that it goes to Gzeres Hashmad, and the Ramban recounts over there some of the terrible things that they've done to Jews through the ages. Ramban writes how they used to crush the bones and testicles of Jews to get them to confess, to convert to Christianity, or to leave Judaism. And you get the feeling from the Ramban that these are such hideous acts that they go beyond anything allowed in the Torah. And the question is, do we have any evidence anywhere in the Torah that beyond the specified punishment, such as, beating of 39 Malkus, skila, hereg, chenek, hanging, that punishments that go beyond that are allowed? That would be a question I would ask you, Rabbi Ganak.
I mean, it's a good question. We know that if somebody runs away from Bezdin, you're allowed to kill him. Hakataka in any fashion that you can. Some say you have to do it with one of the Dalet Mises Besdin. But I think all the points that you make are really valuable, especially in terms of what's the counter argument to say, is this a useful policy in terms of public policy? And we see from the teaching metrics that you quoted and so on, and now is that there would be, it would be something that would be if we could avoid it, we would. Whether that means it has to be completely obviated or not, especially when we're trying to save people. And, I suspect that it would be permitted if it was absolutely necessary. But again, you're right. If it would be, then we'd have to see what's called absolute necessity, and what if it was a wide-scale program of torture? Maybe that's something we wouldn't, we would look away from, because it would, as you said, it may contaminate the Jewish soul or the body politic.
So under what conditions would you say that the Israeli government should advocate a policy of torture?
In the most extreme case, let's say you have a person has information, and you think the information, again, which is not so obvious, but you think that information can only be gotten through torture, and it would be credible information, and if we didn't get that information, lives would be lost. That would be, I think, permitted or useful.
Yeah. Okay, Rabbi Ginnack, since I have you on the phone, let me ask you another question. I know the OU attends the, in mass, the candle lighting at the White House, at the Hanukkah, the White House's Hanukkah party. And at the White House's Hanukkah party, a bracha is made at the lighting. Now, do you think halachically... And I hope I'm not catching you off guard here, because I didn't tell you I would throw this into my questions. We'd speak about this. Mm-hmm. Do you think halachically a bracha should be allowed on the lighting of the candles in the White House, being that we all know that it's Neirish Ubeso, and it's unclear to me whether the president's Beso, whether the White House would go into that? Or do you think that the overriding concept of presume nisa would allow for a bracha in this situation?
I don't think so. I know that the Rav was of the opinion that we light in the shul. He quoted a going there. It's because there's a chiyuv tzibur. When the tzibur is created, it's in shul, so there's a chiyuv to light candles. I don't know outside of Yishu Beiso. And Obama's house, President Obama's house doesn't count for that. Now, obviously, Chabad has a different view about this, because they're lighting menorahs, because of Pesum Nisa all over the country. But I know the Rav thought otherwise. And it may very well be that, that we light in a shul is restricted only to shul, not when there's a general at Sibur, because the minig of lighting in the shul, which is only a minig, may be based on, because the shul is a mikdash ma'at, and it's like a hadlok in the base of mikdash, we see that because the minig is at night we light with the bracha, because it's the time of hadlokas neiros, it's the tekim of Ner Chanukah. But we light, there's a minig also to light during the day, and it would seem that minig to light during the day was because of the shittas of Rambam, that they used to light the menorah in the base of mikdash, both in the doing because of hadlokas neiros during the day as well as at night. So, there are those who think that it's okay to make, assuming that, because there's a whole tzibur more than a minyan, obviously, and it's permitted. I guess for Chabad it wouldn't be a problem. That's their position. But I don't think Rav Soloveitchik thought that way.
You are listening to Headlines, Halakhic Debates of Current Events with David Lichtenstein, founder and CEO of the Lightstone Group and author of Headlines. Please call 212-769-1925 with your questions and comments. That's 212-769-1925. You can also email us at info@talklinecommunications.com. That's info@talklinecommunications.com. If you are enjoying tonight's radio show, please make sure to read David Lichtenstein's important and innovative new book of the same title as this broadcast, Headlines, Halakhic Debate of Current Events, published by OU Press. Embark on a fascinating journey through halakha on some of the most important and controversial breaking issues of the day. Available at your local Jewish booksellers and at Amazon.com.
KCN, Talk Line Communications Network Radio, America's number one Jewish program.
We're going back to the program. Devorah from Newark, your question for David Lichtenstein and Rabbi Menachem Ganek.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. I want to take a different tack. With Rabbi bringing up the conundrum, it may lead towards a single individual if we're likely or possibly going to say Tel Aviv or a large number of people there. I want to put forward an illustration. When Moses did a first counting of the people in the wilderness, he did so under the authority of Hashem. Hashem told him to. Then when King David got into trouble, it was when he was feeling his geopolitical oats and decided he would see how powerful he was and did a census of the people, a counting of the people. And it took the prophet Gad to say, you've just crossed the line because you did that under your own authority. You didn't do it because Hashem told you to. And you have three choices, pestilence, sword, or famine, and your choice. And the problem wasn't the census or the counting of the people. It was acting on your own initiative instead of under the initiative of Hashem. Now, since we all know that we're B'Tselem, and that by violating the B'Tselem in another, we're not to do that. The greater question is, which is the greater challenge, violating the B'Tselem in the individual in order possibly to save a large group of people, or not violating the B'Tselem in a person through torture and allowing the Almighty to do whatever it is he's going to do that to save that large number of people. Maybe or maybe not that will happen. We don't know. He sees things we can't. So it's when we take the initiative outside of his authority that may be the question here, rather than the problem of torture itself.
Well, of course, you know, he communicates his authority through observing the halacha and following the dictates of halacha. So what we're trying to define, you know, and I have to acknowledge that, you know, the parameters are not so obvious by any means. You know, what does halacha tell us? And that's God makes himself known to us through the halacha. So we know that there are principles, roidif, pikuach nefesh. You know, we're trying to see what are, in a contemporary context, how do those principles play out in this context.
Yes, Rabbi, but if we know that within our own purview, it's rather like casting bread upon the water, that when I operate within the framework that is clear to me, that I'm to treat every person as B'Tselem, and that's casting bread upon the water. What happens to that bread after that is up to Hashem and not to me. And it's a matter of figuring out where I begin and end and where Hashem begins and ends. And when we start acting in his authority beyond what he tells us to do, maybe that's where we cross the line regarding our misunderstanding and how we can abuse other people in order to accomplish a larger charge that maybe is not ours to accomplish because it won't work out as we imagine it will from our limited point of view. Whereas we do know we are to treat every person as B'Tselem and not profane God by torturing them.
Well, you know, again, no one thinks that torture is, you know, the first choice, and or that there aren't, you know, costs associated with it, you know, that's detrimental. But I don't believe in this quietist view. We'll just sit back and God will take care of everything for you. You know, we have to, otherwise we don't need an army.
Oh, that isn't what I was meaning, sir, at all. It wasn't the quietist point of view. It's about submission and a humbleness about where I begin and end and where he begins and ends. And sometimes accomplishing the greatest good has to do with knowing I really don't know what's about to happen, but I do know what it is I'm supposed to do.
Right. Okay.
And that I'm to act under his authority and not under...
Mm-hmm. I think that that's a good principle to work on in general. In other words, and that probably is part of, you know, what's you know, we have to factor into this very question, but absolutely it has to be approached with a lot of humility.
DeVore, thank you, Frico. We appreciate a good question. Thank you.
Sure.
Here's an email question, gentlemen, coming in. Please discuss some of the sources in Tanakh and Gemara, that's Talmud, which deal with torture, and one of the Jewish kings in Tanakh, I believe Achav, is criticized by Chazal for torture, for splitting open the bellies of pregnant women for the sake of torture during a war.
Well, I don't know the source, so I think Rabbi Lichtenstein just cited an important source, you know, that we should always keep in mind about the Shita Mekubetzes that says that Hananya, Mishael, Azaria, Tidmar says, would they tortured, they would have succumbed. And so Toysis is bothered. What does it mean they would have succumbed? They would worship the idol. It's one of the three mitzvahs of Avodah Zarah that we have to, you know, give up one's life rather than violate. So Toysis says it wasn't real Avodah Zarah. And the Shita Mekubetzes, which Rabbi Lichtenstein cited before in Ksuba, says that, no, you see, that their lives they would have had to have given up, but not to succumb to torture, you know, that's beyond what the Torah expects of them. So we see, you know, I think that's an important source to cite in terms of how horrible torture is. And as the speaker, the questioner before said, you know, we should recognize that, and it diminishes us and diminishes the Sen Elokim, and therefore it's something that we should, you know, we should avoid, if, and I just have to add two words, if possible. But, you know, it's often, as I said, it may very well be counterproductive, and you have to see the context, you know, of each case. And this is only for discussion purposes. I've been looking at the same time. You know, David mentioned at the beginning, we're not here, these are questions, Shalom, because of, you know, because of the pain inflicted, because of the Talmud Kim, because, you know, everything that we find horrible about it, and that's why it's such a serious question. But it's also a serious responsibility that people have, whether it's soldiers, commanders, or, you know, to protect the security of the population and innocent people who have been murdered day after day in Israel. I just want to mention that, you know, in Har Nof, there were four Jewish victims and the Druze policemen who were brutally murdered. So let's say we had that information, we could have gotten that information before, we'd have saved those people's lives. I mean, there's a case and a counter case, those to be cited. One of those people who were killed was actually a friend of mine, Rabbi Moshe Twersky, who was the Rabbi Soloveitchik's grandson. And he was the sweetest, most humble, very, very brilliant person, but very, very humble person. So these issues are not easily sorted out, but we should remember that just as you know, we speak about the Tzelem Elokim of the potential perpetrator, Kal v'chomer, we should think about the Tzelem Elokim of the completely innocent victim.
No, certainly a good point. I just wanted to broaden the conversation just for a few moments. I know we're almost coming to the end, believe it or not, time is flying. And that is, speaking of Israel and dealing with terrorism and the aftermath, is Israel has been in a position where it has traded literally thousands of people just to save one or two lives. And the question, though, is, and it's maybe we have to discuss more in a future week regarding that, but halachically, can the Israeli government trade so many lives to save one life, but the lives of terrorists is what it's giving away, and some of these terrorists might kill again. So what is the responsibility halachically? How do you look at it from that perspective?
Well, you know, there's an interesting tshuva that's the shach brings a question, a shaila. It's a shach that shalaybim kaimai. It's in Hilchos Mechiras Karkois. He brings a question where a Jewish fellow was grabbed by a warlord, and he was sentenced for execution for some trivialty. And he was a very connected fellow, this Jewish fellow, and he knew somebody who could get him released. from this bloodthirsty warlord. So I think he brings it from Erlbach. Somebody who lived around 400 years ago was asked this question, and he was asked, but he was told that if they release him, they'll just arbitrarily grab another comrade of his, another fellow Jew, and execute him. It seemed that they had some type of a provisional quota to kill X number of Jews a month over there. So if they would have released him, they would have immediately substituted him with another Jew. Could he allow himself, could he use his protector, quote-unquote, to be released or not? And the Merlbach answers, and he brings Raya from a Gemara in Bava Metzia, that he's not allowed to do it. And what's his Raya? His proof is, it says that David HaMelech, King David, loved Mephibosheth, which is one of the children of Shaul. And the Givonim, Shaul had been cruel to them, and they had placed a curse upon the land of Israel, and they had been in a hunger there for 12 years. And the only way to appease them is the Givonim wanted that seven of Shaul's descendants be killed. So how did they know who were, choose his descendants? They passed them in front of the Urim V'Tumim, it says in Malachim, and when it would light up. And though, when it lit up, they would remove them from the line, and those seven would be killed. So it said David used his best efforts to have Mephibosheth removed. So Tosfos asks, how could he have Mephibosheth removed? He's basically forcing somebody else to be killed in his stead. So he says, no, he didn't have him removed. He just prayed that it wouldn't light up when he was there, but he would not be allowed to do an action to have him removed if he knew somebody else would be placed there in his stead. So based upon that, he said, he cannot ask somebody to have him released if he knows somebody else would be put there in his stead. So based upon that, I think it would be problematic. I thought one of the problems is that if you release 1,000 terrorists, and many of whom are known murderers who have forsworn to continue murdering and to re-enter Hamas or whatever designated terrorist organization and kill more people, basically it's the equivalent of asking for your release knowing that somebody else's blood will be replaced with your own blood. And based upon that Shach and that Gemara, I think it would be problematic. Rabbi Ginnack, what's your opinion as to that?
Well, we know that the Mishnah says in Gittin that Ein Podesh Shvuyim Yesh Tachmei Bechdei Demeyim, that there are limits to when, you know, there is a mitzvah Pidyon Shvuyim, but we know that if we give in to ransom, that that'll motivate them to look for other people to kidnap and to hold as held captive. And what David knows, we just know from practical experience, that many of these terrorists who were just released recently or in the Shalit deal became perpetrators and killed other people afterwards, including the soldier in Tel Aviv that was killed.
Is that true? Is that was somebody released in the Galit in the Shalit deal?
I think so, yeah. Were subsequently arrested or accused. That's... in terms of being perpetrators or behind some of these murders. So, that's the argument against. And just to give you the argument for the release, what motivated the prime minister is that one of the things that every Israeli soldier knows, that they will do everything they can to bring their soldiers back alive or dead. And so, that's in terms of the morality of the fighting force and the army, that's something that they factor in. I mean, this argument, just was going on here in the United States when President Obama released many Taliban prisoners to get the release of the American soldier who really, he went AWOL, and that's how he was captured. So there was somewhat of a dispute within the military and others whether that's the right position. So, the argument's both pro and con, but we should always cite the case of the Marami Rutenberg, who was taken captive by the local duke, because he knew the Jewish community would pay any ransom to get him back, and he instructed that he should not be redeemed, and he died in jail because he knew that if they would have redeemed him, every local authority, Duke Eligosha, would see this as a precedent. They'd imprison the leaders of the Jewish community and hold them as hostage.
I was actually by the caver, the gravesite of the Merami Rutenberg. I forgot which city he's buried. I was there many years ago. And buried next to him is the man who redeemed him from jail posthumously. I think it was 9 or 11 years after he died that this fellow paid the ransom, some type of a ransom, to get him his bones redeemed, and he's buried alongside him, and both of their graves still exist. I forgot in which city. That's somebody who was very selfless and said, don't pay for me, as opposed to, the Shalit deal, where they released 1,000 terrorists, which, as you know, many Israelis were opposed to. But you're right. I mean, the halacha that Rabbi Ganak, the Mishnah that he's referring to, is that the Mishnah says that you don't redeem a captive for more than his worth. And there's a machloikis, there's a disagreement as to what the reason is. One reason in the Mishnah says either because not to cause poverty, not to bring poverty upon the masses because of the great, financial demands. And the other reason is because it goads them to capture more people. And we know that if you read Arab literature, terrorist literature, they will do anything at this point to capture another Israeli soldier because they know that there is no price name that is too high. So in effect, we are just, pushing them. We are, recreating the monster here, right? So that is, and the Shulchan Aruch Paskins, the rules, like the second way, that it's because of, we don't pay more because it causes, incites them to capture more people. And halachically, it's very difficult. Rabbi Ganak said that the reason to do it is because of the morale of the Israeli soldiers. And I believe Rabbi Ovadia Yosef was the one who said that for the morale of Israeli soldiers, you can, I believe he wrote this tshuva when they were going to free the soldiers in Entebbe. And the problem was, were they allowed to, because they were putting many other soldiers at risk, many planes at risk. And he said that even though halachically it's possible that you couldn't, because you're not supposed to put yourself at risk to save somebody else's life, or in grave danger to put yourself in somebody else's lives, he says in times of war, this law becomes waived, and he considered Entebbe an act of war, and therefore he allowed the Israeli forces, in which, Bibi Netanyahu's brother was killed, actually, so it was, he did actually, it became true, this prophecy actually, did occur. And because he invoked what Rabbi Ganak said, the morale of the Israeli soldiers.
And we're coming to the close of the show, so thank you and for both being on the show. Very, very special progress, and I thank you to Joy in Manhattan. Your email, I'll just quickly read it. I urge everyone to see the exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art from Assyria to Iberia. There is a relief of a war between the Assyrians located in northern Iraq and the Elamites located in Persia or Iran. The Assyrians are depicted beheading the Elamites. Do you seriously think the Assyrians radicalized the Elamites? Truly, if the Elamites had had the upper hand, they would have beheaded the Assyrians. Let's not worry about the terrorists. Think of us. And it's debatable whether the measures discussed in the Senate report amount to torture. I think not. So, gentlemen, good vach, and Shavua Tov, and a Freilich Hanukkah.
Thank you very much, Zev. Thank you, Rabbi Ganak.
Okay, thank you, David. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Headlines, Halakhic Debates of Current Events with David Lichtenstein, founder and CEO of the Lightstone Group and author of Headlines. Please join us again next week for another edition of Headlines.
TCN, Talk Line Communications Network Radio, America's number one Jewish program.
If you are enjoying tonight's radio show, please make sure to read David Lichtenstein's important and innovative new book of the same title as this broadcast, Headlines, Halakhic Debate of Current Events, published by OU Press. Embark on a fascinating journey through halakha on some of the most important and controversial breaking issues of the day. Available at your local Jewish booksellers and at Amazon.com.
For all your cleaning and dry cleaning needs, no one beats Barnett Cleaners and Expert Tailoring, located at 5403 13th Avenue in Brooklyn. Barnett Cleaners specializes in fine garments, gown cleaning, wedding dresses, skirts, tablecloths, gitlock, and of course, shirts laundered from Beckershires to pants and everything in between. They also offer same-day service. So next time you need to get your clothes laundered, don't get taken to the cleaners unless it's Barnett Cleaners and Expert Tailoring, 5403 13th Avenue in Borough Park. For more information and free pickup and delivery in Borough Park and Kensington, please call 718-436-9549. That's 718-436-9549.